What Really Happened with your host, Mike Rivero. You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, where you'll find out what the Fukushima's going on.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to our show, hour number three. And joining us for this hour is author Donald Jeffries, and he's written a book called Survival of the Richest. It's out on Amazon, a couple of other places like Skyhorse Publishing. And Donald, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Mike.
Okay, so just to get right on into it, tell us about the book. Why did you write it? And what is it really all about?
Well, it examines what I think is the most important issue in America today, and that's the disparity of wealth, the fact that our wealth has been transferred upwards over the last 30 years or so into the hands of fewer and fewer individuals. I think it's the most important issue. Obviously, the right is not going to address this issue, and the left surprisingly steers away from it. I mean, Bernie Sanders draw attention once in a while to a living wage and so forth, but they don't tackle the big issue, which is I think this is a populist issue, and that's what I'm a populist. So this is not your conventional left-wing attack on the rich. It's a populist theme thing where I don't like concentration of power in the hands of too few people, and I think we clearly have that today in terms of wealth.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And as we've seen with George Soros, people with huge amounts of money seem to feel that gives them a right to mess around with the planet and its people like it's a personal toy. And we ought to be cautious because, of course, these individuals absolutely were not elected to have this kind of power and authority over us.
No, absolutely not. And with power, wealth comes great power. I mean, there's that old expression, affluence means influence, and that's what you have today. You can't have a first world economy, I don't believe, with the kind of disparity of wealth we have. And just since I've written the book, I mean, the book has been out for several months, but I completed it basically a couple years ago, and the statistics have grown worse since then. I mean, I just read one last week where it came out with that 50% of Americans, the bottom half of this country, make $27,000 or less a year. That's almost impossible for me to believe because and anywhere in this country, you're in Hawaii, you know what the cost of living is there, but in most parts of the country, unless maybe a few places in Mississippi, Arkansas like that, perhaps you might be able to get a one-bedroom apartment or something on a salary like that, and that's $27,000. That's $27,000 or less. I don't believe that you can have a first world nation with that kind of disparity of wealth. Half your country already, 50%, has less than 1% of the collective wealth. Basically, half the country has nothing, and which each wave of immigration, whether it's legal or largely illegal, all those people are entering at the bottom of the economic ladder, and they're just simply dragging the numbers down even further because they're desperately poor. So obviously they're going to wind up at the bottom. They're not bringing any wealth into the country.
Well, that's been a big problem for quite some time in that going back 30 years when our manufacturing started to decline in terms of both quantity and quality, less wealth was coming into the country from outside. We have $1.5 billion a day trade deficit because American consumers are living off of these imported products made in factories in other countries. And so there have been attempts to try and make it look like this is okay. In the 1980s, they had the so-called service economy, where the idea was we could make our nation prosper by doing each other's laundry for a fee. But anybody will tell you that if you're going to have a strong functioning economy, you have to have the general population engaged in the growing of or manufacturing of products or services that can be sold to other countries to balance the trade deficit. And because of the way our banking system is structured, no matter how hard people work, the more and more share of the product of their work is siphoned off by the banking system. And you're absolutely right. It is hideously out of control right now. If you go back and you look at the history of countries hovering on the edge of revolution, you will see that they were in periods of tremendous wealth inequality. A good example be the France before their revolution, right, or the United States under King George III's Currency Act. And I'm not advocating revolution, but I'm saying it is a symptom that has to be looked at.
No, and John F. Kennedy, you know, famously said, those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. And that's the situation where we're going to come to at some point, because sooner or later, it's going to be, you know, when I don't know what the critical mass will be when it's 60-70% of the people have less than 1% of the collective wealth. I don't know what that would be. But the problem is, everyone who's in a position of influence at all that has a public platform, except, you know, writers like me that are trying to reach, you know, hopefully a bigger audience. But anyone on television, most of your celebrities, obviously, they're all in the 1%. So the system is working great for them. And they have no reason to protest. And it's the people that are out there, the people that I've talked to, you know, the college graduates that can't get a job. We're talking about, and this tax plan that just passed is just going to make things worse. One of the deductions they eliminated was the deduction for student loans. The average student loan in America now is $32,000. And that's just incredible. And these kids are the ones that are going to school now. That looking at the bigger picture, only 11% of college graduates come from that bottom income quadril. The poorest people, poor people don't go to college. And most people don't realize that when they talk about education and they make these little, you know, sound bites to that effect. I mean, who's not in favor of education? The problem is at this point, college is not a good deal. And it really only caters to the people that are in that top 20%, or maybe if you stretch it to the top 50% to one degree or another. But the people in that lower end of that top 50% are tend to getting jobs. First of all, they usually have to get the student loans. They're saddled with tremendous debt. I mean, I work with someone who's still paying off a student loan. He's in his 50s. Goes back that far, and he has a decent job. But you know, if you have a $50,000 student loan or something, and you get a job coming out of college making $30,000, do the math. I mean, is that worth it? And how long will it take you to pay that off? So, I think that's the subject we have to explore. And then you mentioned trade. That's the other big thing. And it certainly was one of the main attractions that I believe Trump had to populists like me. He's the first one that actually talked about the disastrous trade deals. But we still have all those people that used to work in the factories that didn't go to college but had decent jobs. They had strong unions. And even without strong unions, the presence of unions lifted all the wages up. They made decent lives for themselves. And those people, those kinds of people still exist. If everyone goes to college, the value of a college, each college diploma obviously plummets. So we have to have people out there that can make a living as they once did in factories. We need to start building something. We need to have some kind of production in this country. And as you mentioned, we're a service economy. We can't just keep washing each other's cars or whatever.
Well, the problem with modern education is it's more about indoctrination, and we hear about all these snowflakes with their little bubble wrap and their trigger words and everything, and you realize that the colleges, even with all the student loans, are not really preparing these young people for the real world, either in terms of job skills or their ability to deal with the adversity that you're going to encounter as you get out into the job market and the corporate race. And these kids are not prepared for it. What are they going to do the first time they come up against somebody who's competing for the same promotion they are? Just break down and cry and say, you're discriminating against me? School has been turned into a racket, like so many other things in this country. It's not about education anymore. It's just another way to take young people and plunge them on that debt hook as early and as hard as possible and keep them there for the rest of their lives.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And not only have the debt, as you mentioned, they're not learning much of anything. And that's in my first book, Hidden History, one of the problems I've run into trying to talk to, especially young people, is that Americans largely are historically illiterate, as I'm sure you probably know. But young people especially are, because they don't learn any real history in school. They learn a few sound bites, the kind of things that we see on television. They don't learn any, and obviously they don't know math. They don't learn much of any value, but they do get lots of social indoctrination, the social justice warrior type of stuff. And they learn about transgender bathrooms and nonsense like that. And that's why the left is so, I mean, I am, you know, this book is about as far left-wing as it could be, but I really don't like the conventional leftists today, because they're all wrapped up in that social justice warrior type of stuff. And that's where people like me are caught. You know, we're caught in the middle between those social justice kind of authoritarians that want to shut down free speech, want to get people fired over the slip of a tongue, and then the right wing, which is just sold on the Ayn Rand philosophy of, you know, don't love your neighbor and just pure greed and how much profit can I make, and, you know, he who dies with the most toys wins, looking out for number one. So I don't know, you know, where there is a place anymore for an old-fashioned classic liberal or certainly a populist in today's world, but I think that's what we need if we're going to make life as good as we possibly can for as many people as we possibly can.
Well, I'm in agreement with you on that one, and that's why I like to describe myself as a paleocon, which goes back to the original principles of conservatism, which meant limited government, and you're there to just create a climate in which people can, if they choose, better themselves through work and education. But today we have the liberals that are trying to follow along with this idea that they want to engineer a society around us, and through that engineered society, engineer what we think and what we know. One of the biggest failings I see in modern education, and this is at all levels, not just colleges and universities, but especially down in the grade school levels, the one thing they are not teaching kids to do is how to think and analyze critically, rationally. And it's all about belief. It's believing in the soundbite. And so education, along with all of its other failings, it's turned into a big lie, because these kids are getting these degrees for something like art history major or whatnot, and they walk out of that graduation thinking they're educated and they know what's going on. And they don't. They just have a head that's filled with all the propaganda that they borrowed money to have fed to them over the preceding years.
Yeah, and it's all about your feelings. How does that make you feel? And, you know, that's kind of the politics of feeling. You know, and we saw that with the election of Trump, where, you know, you had the students basically shut down, and they were handing them coloring books. I mean, things that, looked like onion stories to me. I could not even believe that was real. But it was all because of what they were feeling, and obviously they were indoctrinated to the media. And it's so much of this problem is also the way that the major media reports things. I mean, for instance, they kind of allude to, I mean, I can get lots of my stories for Survival of the Richest off of sites like Huffington Post and so forth, but they don't approach the subject the way I do, where they don't look at it, okay, like, what is the value? Why, for instance, if the marketplace, is such a sacred thing, certainly to conservatives, then why do golden umbrellas exist? You know, why does a Carly Fiorina get a $40 million golden umbrella? You know, that's more money than most people earn in a lifetime. To leave Hewlett-Packard after she ran them in the ground. And that's just, I'm using her example because then she somehow felt qualified to run for president of the United States afterwards after doing that bang-up job. But we see this over and over again. I mean, we recently saw it in the NFL, a guy like Roger Goodell, who, like so many of these guys, didn't build anything. His father was a United States senator. That put him in a position to succeed. He's been awful. He's killed a corporate entity I did not think could be killed. The NFL is on life support now it's largely because the person leading it is not getting, approaching this from a rational point of view. Okay, well, we've offended the fans, whether you like it or not. We've offended them. We have to do something to address that. They're not doing that. They're planting their feet in and becoming more stupid by the minute. And he actually told, hey, look, you got to raise my salary and give my family free health insurance for life. And they acceded instead of saying, no, you've done a horrible job. We'll bring someone else in. Nope. They acceded to it. And that's what happens, is that we see this over and over again. But these are the same people that say that, if we raise the minimum wage, the prices will go up. Somehow they don't go up with the $40 million umbrellas or the tremendous bonuses we see. And as I quote in the book several times, including the banks that we bailed, I believe six of the banks that we bailed out in 2008 had more money paid out in bonuses that year than the company made in profits. And I don't know how that can possibly even be. There's certainly not a business model, and it certainly doesn't reflect any kind of true capitalism. And we see it over and over again, and that's what I talk about in the book, is that this is what we have is crony capitalism. We don't have free enterprise. We have kind of a plutocracy, and it's more of a fascism, where you have the merger of government, because we see so many perks, corporate welfare that the government gives, especially with the NFL owners, how many times we see the stadiums being built by taxpayer funds and so forth. This is the kind of thing we see. Capitalism, fascism, I believe, can be defined as a merger between corporate and government power, and I think that's what we see, and that's the way I'm approaching this issue. And I think people need to look at it that way, because wealth is a finite thing, and we have to have it not trickle down, but people have to be able to purchase things, buy things, so that businesses can you can sell whatever products we're importing, but we're still here selling them. You have to have some kind of ability for your citizens to be able to engage in your economy. And right now we have half of the population basically has nothing, and I don't see how you can continue without the economy crumbling.
Well, you put everybody on credit. I mean, the retailers are claiming they've had a good holiday shopping season, and the corporate media is trumpeting. It's another indicator that the economy is turning around. But the vast majority of the holiday shopping was done on credit cards. And to my mind, that's made things a lot worse. Now, I'm fully in agreement with you that we are not a capitalist nation any longer, that we have gone down the path to fascism. And by the way, that comment about fascism being a merger of government and corporate interests against the general population, that goes all the way back to Benito Mussolini, who I'm sure we all understand won the Olympic gold medal for being a fascist jerk. But he's absolutely right. We are a fascistic economic system, and one of the symptoms that we see of it is that apparent incompetence, if not criminal people, seem to get incentivized. They get bailed out, they get golden parachutes, they get amazing retirement deals, even when they do a horrible job. I'm in agreement with you of this Carly Fiorina, what she did to Hewlett-Packard, because I'm old enough to remember when Hewlett-Packard really meant something. It really was one of the best American companies. I was introduced to their equipment when I worked for NASA all those years ago, and I've had Hewlett-Packard calculators throughout my career. And then when my wife and I started a company here on Oahu, because of my past relationship with Hewlett-Packard, we bought all HP equipment for our shop, and it all started failing like crazy. And I hadn't realized that Carly Fiorina, when she'd taken over Hewlett-Packard, had changed all their supply chains to just go with the cheapest available components they could find, slap an HP logo on it, and put it in the store. It's almost a lot like the storyline from Michael Crichton's Disclosure. If you go back and you read that. And it was a warning that this rush toward profit above all else was leading to a situation in which the very best American companies were being taken over and simply exploited for their name to put out absolute junk. And at this point, I'm never going to buy a Hewlett-Packard product again after getting burned that badly.
Yeah, and I think we see that kind of corporate mindset in someone like a Paul Ryan, I think, reflects it perfectly, because these guys are disciples of Ayn Rand, and it's the greed is good mentality. It's what was spoofed in the movie Wall Street, but it's become mainstream now. And it's profit for its own sake. That's all that matters. Now, the old line capitalists, even the old the old robber barons, going back that far, at least most of them founded their own companies. So they had a first generation interest in that company. And you look at somebody like a Henry Ford, who was violently anti-union, but he famously raised his workers' wages, and all the other kind of barons said, "Well, why'd you do that?" And he said, "Well, I have to pay him enough to be able to afford the car." And people today that are running things, they don't think that when they don't give their workers a raise every year, the cost of living continues to raise. I mean, these people, it used to be, I can remember when those of us would complain about only getting a 3% cost of living raise. Most of us would love to get that now. But instead, you had the people at the top getting huge bonuses every year. Most of the workers below them get nothing, or don't even get a yearly raise, let alone a bonus. And it's that kind of dichotomy between what's happening with the perks and the benefits and the raises, and we've seen it again, especially since the 80s. What has happened with the union? The power of unions kind of going down to virtually nothing now. And therefore, they're in with the impact of immigration at the other end. And that's another place I obviously disagree with most people on the left, because most people on the left kind of turn their back on immigration and act like it hasn't had a huge impact on wages, when it's probably had more of an impact on anything else than blue collar wages. And that's why, again, Trump was so promising when he talked about doing something about it. But I was just reading where AT&T, we've got some good press a few weeks ago for giving a $1,000 bonus to 200,000 workers. Well, now it turns out they're laying off people left and right. And it came a story today how they're laying off 600 or 700 workers and replacing them with H-1B visa workers. And I write a lot about that program. There's no reason in the world for it to exist. And Trump criticized it rightfully during his campaign, but he didn't cancel the program. He's made a few modifications that supposedly make it harder for spouses to come over or something, but the program still exists, and I think that would have been a great symbolic gesture to just get rid of it, because you can get rid of it with a stroke of a pen, and there's no reason for it when you have 90 to 100 million of Americans of adult age out of work. It's crazy to be laying off people that have jobs and bringing these people in to replace them.
Well, you're absolutely right. Now, Donald, we're going to have to take a break here for some commercials, and we'll be back with Donald Jeffries, author of Survival of the Richest, after these few words.
so, you love talk radio, then you'll love TalkStreamLive.com. TalkStream Live is always on, 24-7, with the best streaming talk shows. Find your favorite talkers and discover some new ones. It's free, readily available online or on mobile with any smartphone or tablet. Finding your favorite talk shows all in one place has gotten a whole lot easier. Just go to TalkStreamLive.com. Be sure to download the free apps from Google Play or the iTunes App Store.
Do you or a loved one suffer migraine headaches? Listen to what scientist Kurt Hendricks has to say.
If you are one of the millions of people who get migraines, you need to know about MigRelief. Hi, I'm Kurt Hendricks, the scientist who created MigRelief, the patented dietary supplement that addresses nutritional deficiencies in adults and children with migraines. Thousands of physicians and pharmacists recommend MigRelief.
Call 800-MIG-7354 or visit MIG911.com.
My name is Don Wiskin, and at 42 years old, I suffered a massive heart attack, lost 35% of my heart to damaged tissue, and was supposed to spend the rest of my life on disability. What did I do? I took Extendivite, a garlic and cayenne mix of seven herbs which rebuilt my heart and gave me back my life. For over 17 years now, I have made this formula available to you, so you don't have to suffer the same thing I did. Clean your blocked arteries and strengthen your heart and boost your natural immune system. I'm 60 years old now and I still work every day. To get your Extendivite, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2, keep it today.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Visit us online at whatreallyhappened.com. And now, set your eyes on the future and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. We're talking with Donald Jeffries, author of Survival of the Richest. And Don, I want to step back here to something that you talked about when you mentioned in the age of the robber barons, these were people who started their own companies and they had an attachment to them, at least for the first generation. And that was an important factor because, again, back then, along with being emotionally connected to the creation of the company, people started businesses to be in business, not to try and build them up and then sell them out real quickly. And more importantly, there was a very tragic phenomenon that happened at the close of World War II, because the United States came out of World War II in a tremendously advantageous position. We were the only industrialized nation that still had its industrial base intact. All the other industrialized nations had had their factories bombed into rubble. And so there was this golden age where other nations that were trying to rebuild their factories had to come to the United States and buy machine tools, ball bearings, various other things. It was a boom time for American companies. And there quickly developed a crisis because these companies that were making all of these products to send on out to the rest of the world, they couldn't afford to promote their workers on the floor into new management positions as these businesses grew, because these were the guys who knew how it all actually worked. And so Harvard Business School decided to come up with a new theory of mid-level management called scientific management, and they developed a set of tools that supposedly could apply to any business engaged in any kind of activity. And then they created a degree program to go with it, the Masters of Business Administration, or the MBA. And Harvard's thinking was that somebody with an MBA could be working at a car factory this week and be doing a good job as a mid-level manager. And then a month down the road, they could be working in pharmaceuticals. And a month down the road, they could be working at a bread factory. And it did work and fill the levels of mid-management over the rapidly expanding American industrial output. The problem is it created a generation of mid-level managers who did not have that emotional connection to the business, had no respect for the actual process of making whatever product was being sold. And those mid-level managers post-World War II are now the corporate leaders of our industry today. And they still have zero connection emotionally to what's actually being made on the floor. And that's why it's very easy for them to go along with debasing the quality of the product, or even worse, offshoring the manufacturing to other countries that are manufacturing powerhouses like China, and just say, we'll let them deal with the grease under the fingernails. All we need to do is manage the money and the supply chain. And so one of the worst things that really happened followed the tech boom of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Now, all of that was born in the Apollo moon program. In solving those problems of getting to the moon and back, the U.S. invented all kinds of new materials, new technologies, integrated circuits, things that we take for granted today just didn't exist before Apollo. And a lot of new companies started up making products with those new technologies. But for the most part, the holders of those licenses simply licensed other countries to make those products. So the job creation that came out of this technology funded by the U.S. taxpayer wound up being in other countries like China, like Taiwan, like South Korea. And those countries are not going to be dumb enough to let it come back here very, very easily. And so for the last 30 years, our manufacturing domestically has been in a decline in quantity and quality. And topping that off, of course, the rest of the world does not want our GMO agriculture. And that's why we're in a real mess. And it seems like, and your book seems to reinforce the idea, that the wealthy in the United States are just totally focused on grabbing as much of what remains of the nation's wealth to themselves before it all starts coming apart.
Oh, I certainly agree with all that. And you're right. I think it is really as simple as that. It's a kind of a caricature of the rich to think that they're just, you know, they're greedy. But I really think the 1% at least, especially the top 1% of the 1%, the people at the very top that have just an incredible amount of wealth, I think that's all they're consumed with is just maintaining that. That's why you hear so many stories about, you know, Bill Gates going out and not even tipping 15% of the time, half the time. I mean, this is the world's, I guess Jeff Bezos is the richest guy now, but until recently, Gates had been number one for a long time. So if the richest man in the world can't give a waitress a decent tip, I don't know what kind of world, but that's the kind of mentality they have. And then of course you have people on the right that just say, well, that's how he got his money. It's like, okay, yeah, that's how he, but, and I think that's,
well, not exactly, but you know, having money is actually addictive. And there was a documentary that came out called Inside Job some years ago. It won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Documentary, looking at the 2008 mortgage-backed security fraud meltdown. And one of the things they had in this documentary is that scientists actually wired up the brains of Wall Street traders, and they discovered that when they made a big score, when the number in their portfolio jumped up by another zero, they got this intense rush of pure pleasure from the exact same center of the brain that responds to the use of cocaine. And it's from this a physical process. They're literally an addictive process. They're money junkies, and you get behavior like the Wolf of Wall Street. We got to take another break for commercials. I know our commercial breaks are kind of skewed, crooked here, but when we come on back, we'll have about a good quarter of an hour to talk uninterrupted. We'll be right back.
Oh,
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
I'm getting older and noticing that my body just doesn't work as well as it used to. So I like to keep fit as possible by hitting the gym a few times a week. Recently, I started having a nagging bicep pain, and it got so bad I couldn't even lift the weights. When I was complaining about it to a friend, he told me about Angioprim. He said chelation helps remove toxins, heavy metals, and cholesterol in veins and arteries that may cause blockages. You know, after just 1 week of taking Angioprim, the pain was gone, and now I'm back in the gym full strength. Scientific research proves the active ingredient in Angioprim has superior oral chelation action that helps promote cardiovascular health. So to learn more, go to angioprim.com. That's A-N-G-I-O-P-R-I-M.com. Or talk to a trained consultant. Call Angioprim toll-free at 877-882-7221. You'll feel better with more energy. Call 877-882-7221 or go to the website angioprim.com.
For the past 14 years, it's been my privilege to host the National Intel Report on RBN, to offer a platform to interview exceptional guests, to provoke critical thought, and examine evidence, whether real, fake, or somewhere in between, and allow our audience to call in and participate with your input and questions, in order to help us all reach an educated decision and arrive at our own truth. Our world has changed. It's now been turned on its head. Real is now considered fake, and mainstream fake is now pushed as real, rather than any clear thinking, consensus, or rationale.
Those few remaining beacons of light, the ones still shining through the mainstream media lies, propaganda, and deception, are being viciously attacked at every level through attempts at censorship, threatening advertisers, jailing hosts, and even killing journalists brave enough to speak the truth to you. We are in a war for our very freedom and existence, and through these despicable acts, freedom haters, collectivists, and communitarians have shown they will stop at nothing to blot out these last few beacons of light. Truth is becoming increasingly more difficult to unmask, just as the term unmasking itself is spoken by those usually anonymous sources. They promote their lies, wishing to mask the truths by ignoring it, vilifying it, or conspiratorializing it into a black hole abyss.
Regrettably, RBN has reached the tipping point, and through internal audit and actuarial review, it has now been determined that the only life raft of survival to this network is to go the way of PBS, that being audience-supported. Like a cornered animal, the left with veracity is pulling out all the stops with every effort to effectively blacken our beacon forever. Help us, folks. Help yourselves. Don't let our light stop shining. Our motto has always been, because you can handle the truth. It's time to review your budget, folks. If you want the truth to keep flowing through RBN, go to republicbroadcasting.org and become a regular monthly donor of 30, 40, 50, or 100 or more a month and ensure you keep the truth flowing.
When all this twisted steel was swept away, did these remaining holes reveal what really happened?
And aloha, America. Welcome back to our show here. We're talking with Donald Jeffries, author of Survival of the Richest. And Donald, let's talk about the book itself. And by the way, I've posted a link from whatreallyhappened.com to one of the many venues where you can buy the book for yourself. Give us an overview of the book itself, the contents, what's in it.
Well, again, the subtitle is How the Disparity of Wealth and the Corruption of the Marketplace Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All. And I do think it's the greatest conspiracy of all. You know, we talk a lot about class envy, and that's invariably what you get from conservatives when someone starts talking about, raising the pay of workers, or we're not getting paid enough. Well, that's just class envy. Well, it is class envy because, you know, when half of the country has nothing and you have so few people that haven't, you know, all these trust fund babies and people like that. I had a chapter in the book that was deleted because for length reasons, that where I went into the backgrounds of so many celebrities and so many corporate leaders and just looked into their backgrounds, and I could find barely any, and I'm talking about past and present. I went back to the golden age of Hollywood. Almost all of them came from at least upper middle class backgrounds. And my point was that, you know, you have to – you just have an innate advantage. Wealth gives you an advantage, and we see it from the glaring statistics about it. I think it's 43% of the people that are born in the lowest quartile economically never move out of that quartile. They never move up at all, and 70% never even make it to the middle. And that's the reality that we face. It's very hard. I mean, we can look at these depressed areas and then come up with lots of reasons culturally, perhaps, why they stay that way. But money is very important, and that's I don't think anybody has looked at the subject as I do. I mean, I analyze various occupations, why they pay what they pay, why, for instance, someone being a vice president, I call it vice president in charge of looking out the window. You know, corporate America is filled with these vice presidents in charge of looking out the window. And, they say anybody can do, like, whatever menial job. Anybody can clean the toilets. Anybody can mop the floors. Well, yeah, anybody could, theoretically, but the fact that nobody wants to, it's clearly harder work if you just look at physical labor. And, you know, why can't we say that anybody could be one of these vice presidents? Because in today's corporate America, they are largely just yes men or yes women. They're just they go to meetings and they agree to whatever the CEO says, and that way they get their own fat bonus at the end. So they have obviously a vested interest in agreeing. But my point would be, how many citizens couldn't do that? How many people couldn't be good yes men or women? So when they demean the physical labor, especially, and say anybody could do that, yeah, anybody can do that, I suppose, as long as you're physically capable of it. But that's I think a large subtext of my book is trying to show that all work should be appreciated. And at one point, I mean, I remember back in the 1960s and 1970s, any kind of work, any kind of job, work at a gas station. I mean, I knew one of my favorite talking points is I knew someone that was a cashier at Safeway back in the early 80s, was making $35,000 a year then. It was a good union job. Fast forward to today, and that same cashier is making less than $8 an hour at the same company. Something's wrong with a marketplace like that. What happened? Why was that considered a really mainstream job that was very respected by everyone? And someone who had a job like that or worked at Sears, Montgomery Ward's, a lot of the stores that are out of business or have largely gone out of business, just worked behind a counter in retail, could raise a family, could buy a house. Their wife didn't have to work if she didn't want to, and they could have as many children as they wanted to. Something has happened dramatically in the 50 years since then, because obviously that's not the case now. In most cases, both husband and wife have to work. In many cases, you're limited to the quintessential two children. And we're always struggling with debt, and 72% of Americans, I believe in the latest poll, live paycheck to paycheck. So I think we need to look at that, but no one wants to look at the picture like that. Instead, it's, okay, let's just raise the minimum wage, which is fine. Okay, but let's look at why the workers that have been at a job 10 years, 15 years, why they're not making more money. There's no room for advancement. They run up against, so you talk about the glass ceilings for women or other groups. There's a glass ceiling for workers at almost every job where you just simply don't get raises. And people don't talk about that because it wasn't that way. As recently as 40 years ago, really up until maybe the 80s, any job, you could at least, go rent an apartment. But when half your country is making $27,000 or less in today's dollars, obviously half the country is going to struggle even to go rent a one-bedroom apartment. I think it's just important to look at these issues, and I don't think anyone else is doing that.
Well, one of the factors that we talk about on our show all the time is that for an economy to perpetuate, to continue to function, there has to be a method of recycling accumulated wealth at the top and bring it back down to the bottom as decent wages and salaries, so that ordinary working people, middle class people, can trade their labors and skills for those decent wages of salaries, and then pump that money back into the system to keep commerce going. Prior to the 2008 meltdown of the mortgage-backed security fraud, consumerism accounted for 60% of the U.S. economy. It's nowhere near that anymore. And I'm not sure I'm ready to believe the glorious pronouncements about what a wonderful holiday shopping season we've had this last year. And there's a tremendous short-sightedness with the money junkies in that they seem to have forgotten a simple idea that if you're not allowing workers to earn the money to buy the products you're selling, you're not going to sell those products. You mentioned Henry Ford before. One of the things that he said that I always agreed with is that the best way to become prosperous is to make your community around you prosper. And that was part of the thinking of his paying his workers enough where they could afford to buy the cars they were building. And they became his best advertisement because Ford's entire sales pitch was a car that ordinary workers can afford. Because Henry Ford didn't invent the car. There were already cars all over, but they were rich people's playthings, Daimler Benz and so forth and so on. Ford wanted to popularize the automobile as something for ordinary workers, and paying his employees enough to buy those cars was his most powerful advertising device. And he proved he was right. He was absolutely right. The richer the workers are around you, the more of your product they can buy.
Yeah, it seems to be a simple concept, doesn't it? But it seems to be lost, as you mentioned, short-sightedness. And I think that's what we see in all our leadership today, whether it's government and certainly corporate leadership. There's just an incredible short-sightedness. There's no visionary thinkers out there at all. It's all about, you know, how much is my bonus going to be this Christmas? Really, that's about the extent of their thinking. They lay off, you know, 10,000 workers at the drop of a hat. We've seen that so often. I talk a lot about that in Survival of the Richest, how these layoffs occur in the midst of company prosperity, of record bonuses for the same company, and often their bonuses increase with the number of layoffs. You lay off that many more, but hey, you know, look what you saved the company money. Well, you saved the company money, but you threw thousands of families into turmoil. You created who knows how many divorces and suicides by doing something like that. And yet a lot of these fine folk will still look in the mirror. They'll be able to look at themselves. They'll go to church on Sunday, and they'll call themselves Christians. And it just amazes me that there is no there's no broad thinking. And looking at the big picture, okay, you have to have people. And Americans, I believe, in American leadership, I certainly am studying history. I'm not a fan of many of our past leaders, but at least they recognized, as Henry Ford did, that they weren't quite as greedy, and they didn't call themselves CEOs, I don't believe, until the 80s. I think that was a term that really started being popularized then. But many times it was the company president and even founder that ran the company, and they tended to share, at least to some degree, to have the worker share in their wealth. And we did not see the incredible disparity we see now between CEO pay, executive pay, and worker pay. Back then it was much closer. And so you didn't feel quite as disconnected. You felt that the guy was still a human being. It's, you know, it's like attending an athletic event now, where, you know, in the past, again, up until maybe the 50s or 60s, a lot of these ball players had jobs in the off season, and they were, you know, you could relate to them as average Joes. They lived in a lot of the same neighborhoods that the fans did. Now they're living in sheltered mansions. They're you know, and if you're a baseball, basketball player, every one of those millions that you signed for is fully guaranteed, unlike football. So the average fan cannot relate to them, and I think that's another aspect that is ignored of why the NFL in particular is seeing its ratings and attendance plummet, because they're just, the fans can't relate to people that are in that position. These are all one percenters, and for them to be claiming that you know, they're oppressed or something is the height of ridiculousness.
Well, this gets back to what you were saying about the descent into fascism, because the people who are in these positions of top management have had a paradigm shift. They don't care about the company, they don't care about the product. They're there to make themselves extremely rich. And so the focus has shifted away from running a company well and producing a quality product into simply gaming the system to make sure more money is just flowing toward you. Having government force people to buy the product that you're selling that's not very good, various things like that. And once you get into an environment like that, once you have a government that goes along with that, it's very easy for top management to say, why should I work at making a quality product as long as the government isn't going to arrest us for putting out dangerous, toxic products? Let's just maximize our profitability. I look at that huge stink that they had with the Bayer company some years ago, where it was discovered their blood clotting factor for hemophiliacs was tainted with the HIV virus. And Bayer had to stop selling it in the United States. But instead of destroying this dangerous product, they simply sold it overseas to countries that didn't have any laws protecting the consumer. And a lot of people got AIDS, but Bayer managed to sell the product and not have to take the loss of destroying it all. And that kind of mindset appears to be acceptable behavior. among the elites themselves and among the government as well. The attitude these days seems to be, as long as it makes money, it's okay. And that's why we have these government-mandated vaccines. Talk about forcing people to buy a product they don't want and don't need. We find out the vaccines are completely ineffective. In some cases, they're harmful. But again, when you're in that model, from the vaccine maker's point of view, your stockholders are going to be happy if you just go along with that and they make their money. And it does get back to the reality that money is an addiction.
Yeah, and sure. You create a vaccine. What did Bill Gates' foundation had a vaccine in India that I think caused I don't know how many thousands of cases of paralysis right away. But you know, it's just, people just kind of shrug that off. It's still a good thing. Well, I don't know how that's a good thing, but as you mentioned,
we meant well. That's what they think. We meant well. We had good intentions.
Yeah,
therefore,
sure.
We're off the hook on this.
Yeah.
But in terms of Bill Gates and vaccines, he sees it as a world depopulation mechanism.
Yeah.
Now, we have a caller waiting on the line. I don't know if she has a question for you or for me. Lee from Mount Shasta, California. Aloha. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, the main thing is that a few days back, I heard about the executive order signed December the 17th about blocking the property of persons involved in serious human rights abuse or corruption. And I hadn't heard it. There was several sites on the Internet talking about this, but I haven't heard anything like on Fox News.
Well, I don't know that the corporate media is going to cover it. I mean, we covered it briefly yesterday. The big question, the big issue is apparently the way this executive order is written, it could be applied to everybody who partook of the Uranium One deal, which as time goes by seems to be almost everybody inside the Beltway. The big question is, will it actually be enforced? Because just because the president signs an executive order doesn't guarantee it will be carried out. And a good example of that, of course, would be the executive order signed by President John F. Kennedy that stripped covert paramilitary operations away from the Central Intelligence Agency and handed them to the Pentagon. This was in keeping with Kennedy's professed desire to shatter the CIA and scatter them to the wind. But the EO was never carried on out because the bureaucracy liked things the way it was going. And, of course, Kennedy was eventually removed. Do you have a question specific for survival of the richest for Donald?
No. I just happened to call. I didn't know. I can't listen to your show live. I normally listen to it the next day. And I just thought, well, I'll see if I can get through.
Well, you got through, and thank you very much for the phone call. We're going to let you go. Now, turning on back here to Donald, does your book make any, shall we say, recommendations for things that could correct our current system?
Well, the first thing I think that should be done, and I think no one would object to this, is that they ought to go back to the Grace Commission in the 1980s. One of the things that Reagan, in his quest to downsize government, which he didn't do at all, he had a Grace Commission that was formed, and they appear, unlike most commissions, to have done a pretty good job. And they determined at that time that fully one-third of all government spending is absolute 100% waste and could be eliminated without affecting a single program. Now, I can't imagine that it hasn't gone up since then, but even if it's still only a third, I don't know who could possibly object to cutting spending by one-third and you know, cutting taxes, therefore, by one-third. So I would start there, because I think if that right there would cut at least a third out if you got rid of the waste. And I understand that, you know, so many people are profiting from the waste, fraud, and abuse that we see, but you know, they didn't recognize it at the time, and Reagan is one of the many things he didn't do that he should have done based on his rhetoric. He basically ignored the conclusions of the Grace Commission. I would go with that, and that was the first thing I would do. And then I would look at things like Social Security. To say the Social Security Fund, I would start strictly means testing it, as Ross Perot suggested, at voluntary means testing back in 1992, and he was shouted down by the old folks lobby very quickly, and he went back into his shell. And I would also tax all Social Security income. Most people don't realize what a regressive tax Social Security tax is. Only the first $119,000 of income is taxed. So Bill Gates is, and you know, Warren Buffett, people like that, are paying taxes on $119,000 income for purposes of Social Security. So things like that, I think, could save the Social Security fund. And of course, it's been corrupted by being commingled with all the funds going back to LBJ, and then Reagan really did it when he raised Social Security taxes. But I think those things at least would address those problems. I think Social Security could be saved if those recommendations are made. And I think we need to end something like the H-1B visa programs. All visa worker programs should be ended. There's no need for them when you have 90 to 100 million Americans out of work. That needs to be done. I think...
Now, I'm in agreement with you on that one. But playing devil's advocate, one of the reasons why I think companies go for the H-1B visa program employees, it's not just that they are willing to accept lower pay. It's unfortunately, tragically, they're better educated. And this goes back to what we were saying about education, where it's all about indoctrination rather than education. And we have most of the people coming out of high school or even college don't really have competitive levels of job skills with these people who are educated in other countries. We got to take one more break for commercials. We'll be back with the last segment of our program after these few words.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AirOutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus Magful clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AirOutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at AirOutfitting.com.
Hi, folks. CBD is the home run hitter for health right now. Why, you ask? Because of what it does for the body. Unfortunately, I can't tell you all about the benefit. You know, there's reasons. Do your due diligence and log on to AncientLifeOil.com. That's AncientLifeOil.com. Ancient Life Oil uses organic ingredients and is blended in coconut oil for some of the best benefits. Legal in 50 states and non-psychoactive. Log on to AncientLifeOil.com. That's AncientLifeOil.com.
Do you worry a lot? Whether you're a college student, busy professional, parent, or grandparent, ongoing stress and elevated levels of the stress hormone cortisol can rob your memory, your health, and your future. Now you can combat the effects of stress and anxiety while improving your memory and recall at the same time with the dietary supplement Calm and Clever. Studies show that the ingredients in Calm and Clever reduce cortisol by as much as 30% in 1 to 2 weeks. Call 1-800-758-8746 or calmandclever.com.
We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility. blessings of liberty.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to our show. Last segment of our program today here. We're talking with Donald Jeffries, author of Survival of the Richest. And Donald, I was looking through the email during the commercial break, and I've got some requests. Do you have a website that lists all of your books and all of your articles? I'm not talking about a sales website, but your personal webpage where people can find out more about you, possibly send you an email.
Yeah, I blog regularly. It's my blog is called Keeping It Unreal, after my novel, the 2007 novel, The Unreals. You can find it at donaldjeffries.wordpress.com. I blog pretty regularly there, and I talk about my books. I mean, I've had 3 books published, and so they can find out everything they need to do there.
Okay, and I've got it up here, and I will link to this from whatreallyhappened.com. All right, so Donald, we got about 3.5-4 minutes left here. What else do you want to share with us from the book?
Well, again, I think it's important. I've gotten a lot of feedback from people that are going through. I've heard so many heart-wrenching stories on what people have gone through. People that have, you know, been thrown out of work in their 50s, even 60s. You know, retirement has become another thing that most Americans are just not going to be able to enjoy. Again, 20, 30 years ago, that was most Americans did have pensions, and Social Security was more indexed, a lot closer to the cost of living than it is now. But I think that it's a subject that it really is going to impact everyone. It's going to impact more and more every year, unless the economy really turns around. Unless Trump was telling the truth about bringing industry back, if he can actually get factories back and we can start and industries back again, which I don't know, it may be too late for that, but we're looking at things like artificial intelligence taking millions of jobs. We don't know what kind of impact that's going to have. And our leaders are never been known for their foresight, and they're certainly not looking at that logically either. They're saying, oh, that's great. You know, truckers, we're going to have 10 million truckers going to lose their jobs to self-driving trucks. Well, what's the impact on those 10 million truckers? We don't think of that. And where are they going to go? Into an economy where you already have a glut from immigration, from foreign visa workers, from, you know, people just cutting back and top-heavy management and trying to get as much as they can out of workers at the bottom. We see this over and over again. The old expression, so many of these golden chestnuts, like too many chiefs, not enough Indians, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. They're becoming so obvious now, and more obvious than they've been to me in my lifetime. But I would suggest that as people near retirement age and anyone who's been thrown out of work in this economy and has tried to find a job, especially if they'd been kind of stagnant, as a lot of us are, if they'd been in their position, say, 15, 20 years, and that happens to a lot of people. Suddenly the company goes out of business, or they just decide to downsize, and a lot of times they actually lay off the people that are most senior in status, because seniority has no benefits anymore, and because they're paid more, their benefits are better, so it behooves them to bring in cheaper labor. It's those people trying to find jobs out there in this market. I've had so many people, you know, who's had their eyes have been open. They say, yeah, I'm glad somebody's finally talking about this. So I think anybody who's a part of this economy should read the book.
Well, Donald, we're out of time here. There's the music. I'm going to tell you right now, I want to have you back on the show in the very near future, because I still have a ton of questions I wanted to ask you, and it is an important issue. We are a fascist economic dictatorship. All right, that's the end of our program. Please stay tuned for John Stedmiller. He's got a lot of interesting things to share with you. Go to whatreallyhappened.com. I've put links to where you can buy Donald Jeffries' book. I just put up the link to his blog spot, so you can get in touch with him with your questions. We'll have him back here in the future. So we'll talk to you tomorrow, Friday. Aloha, America.
Do you or a loved one suffer migraine headaches? Listen to what scientist Kurt Hendricks has to say.
35 million people in the United States suffer with debilitating migraines. If you or a loved one are one of them, you need to know about MigRelief. Hi, I'm Kurt Hendricks, the scientist that formulated and patented the MigRelief migraine formula. MigRelief is a non-prescription dietary supplement recommended by neurologists, pharmacists and pediatricians to address nutritional deficiencies in both adults and children over two with migraines. Try MigraLeaf for 3 months and see the powerful difference it can make in your life, or get your money back, no questions asked. Go to MIG911.com or call 800-MIG-7354. You can change your life today.
So if you suffer from migraines, don't wait. Call 800-MIG-7354. That's 800-MIG-7354 or visit MIG911.com.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.